Hi, kids. I want you to sing a nonsense song with me about a cat with her fiddle, a cow and the moon, a silly little dog and the plate with the spoon. Ready? A 1, 2, 3, 4.
Clifford, all right, we're back for another one.
We are indeed. Welcome back, Patrick.
Welcome back to you, too.
We have in front of us Chapter 9, At the Sign of the Prancing Pony. Book 1, Fellowship of the Ring.
All right, so in this episode today, obviously they're in Bree. We got to talk about that. Then we'll talk about the Prancing Pony itself and all the inhabitants. We'll talk about the most mysterious of them, Strider. And we'll finish up talking about the song that Frodo sings and all the events that take place with that. But before all that, Cliff's notes.
So, the hobbits arrive at Bree, a small town in the midst of a small inhabited area surrounded by wild lands. The Bree folk are a mix of men and hobbits, both with old roots. They are strange to the Shire hobbits, and the Shire hobbits are strange to the Bree folk, as are outsiders in general. The group heads to the Prancing Pony, the inn that Tom Bombadil recommended. They are uneasy, but the innkeeper welcomes them in and finds them rooms. After eating, they head to the common room for beer, where many locals are gathered. They are welcoming and curious about the Shire Hobbits, and Frodo's efforts to stay quiet about his contrived identity, Mr. Underhill, are quickly hindered. Frodo meets a strange man in the corner of the room, who calls himself Strider, and in an effort to interrupt Pippin's story about Bilbo's farewell party, fearing that it would give away their purpose for being there, Frodo accidentally creates a scene that draws far more attention to this strange group. The party dies down, suspicious of Frodo and his friends.
All right. Wait. That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, did you mention him putting on the ring?
I alluded to it.
Oh, okay. All right, well, we'll just leave that for the end then.
Yeah.
Might as well start where he started with Bree. Mm-hmm. What, he spent like 2 pages just talking about the city. Didn't even mention the hobbits.
We got a little classic, throwback to, well, we've seen it in Lord of the Rings and also The Hobbit. Introduction of a new place or a new thing where this the story just sidetracks to give us a little history.
But this, I mean, it didn't even sidetrack here. It that was the opening.
Yes. But Bree sounds pretty interesting. Any interesting details stand out to you?
Yeah, so let's just cover what he covered in there. So Bree, it's the chief village of Bree Land, an island in empty lands. Yeah, okay. And then there's a couple other towns near there. Staddle, Combe. Is that how you're saying it? Combe? Combe.
Combe.
Combe? Combe? All right, Combe. Okay. And Archet. Archet? Archet?
Yeah.
Okay.
These all sound like made-up words.
Well, we're going to get to them.
Okay.
give us 5 minutes.
Okay.
All right. The Bree men. What? You got any description of them?
I believe you said they're brown-haired, broad, rather short, cheerful, and independent. They belong to no one.
Yeah. And then it was very interesting that they're very friendly with hobbits, elves, and dwarves, and hobbits even live among them too. Which this is the only place in the world where this, according to him, excellent arrangement can be found.
Yeah, so the men call the hobbits little people, and the hobbits call the men big people. The hobbits live up on the hill, up above the town, and yeah, they cohabitate, which is funny, interesting.
And then we also heard about some mysterious rangers that wander around Bree.
Yes.
You want to read the description of them?
They were taller and darker than the men of Bree, and were believed to have strange powers of sight and hearing, and to understand the languages of beasts and birds. They roamed at will southwards and eastwards, even as far as the Misty Mountains, but they were now few and rarely seen. When they appeared, they brought news from afar, and told strange forgotten tales, which were eagerly listened to, but the Bree folk did not make friends of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, besides that, what? This is a gated town, and it seems like it's at the crossroads of some... It was at ancient crossroads. Like, the roads are no longer used that much.
Yeah, there's a general, impression of oldness, ancientness even, around this town, because the men of Bree are described as being descendants of the first men.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first men who traveled into the West. And when the kings, you'll have to help me out what this is actually referencing, but when the kings returned over the Great Sea, they still found the Bree men there, same as they were before. Even now, the kings are a distant memory, and the Bree folk are still there. So, suggestion that they're part of this really ancient line of men, basically the first men to have settled in this part of the world. And then, well, slightly related, the hobbits who are here claim to be the oldest settlement of hobbits in the world before the hobbits kind of migrated westward towards the Shire and Buckland and everything.
I think the hobbits they're the oldest settlement left, would be my guess. Because I think the ones over the Misty Mountains where they were originally from aren't there anymore.
Understood.
That's how I read it. I'm not...
Point being, both the men and the hobbits in Bree have claimed to basically old history.
Well, so the men are interesting because, so we've talked about it in the past, in the Silmarillion, the elves are fighting Morgoth on like the basically like subcontinent that was west of the Shire, because there used to be like a whole continent there, but eventually it gets flooded. Remember that?
What's it called?
Beleriand.
Beleriand, okay.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. And
it's like the land bridge that connected
the
Undying Lands to Middle-earth.
Right, yeah. And so there, that's where like all the Silmarillion events took place. So while the elves are fighting Morgoth, and they got him hemmed in for like 400 years up north at his fortress, which is Angband / Thangorodrim, men come from the east to the west. So that's what they're talking about here. Like, as the men came westward, some men just stopped at Bree and just established that town, and it's been there ever since. And so then the men in the Silmarillion that help the good ones that help the elves in the Silmarillion, they eventually get the island of Numenor as their reward for helping. But eventually a group of them comes back and they reset up the kingdom in the north, which is Arnor, which we were talking about in the last episode, where they were getting like the swords from the grave mound. Like, those were probably, I forget what we were saying, they were probably the men of Arnor who were overrun by the evil men of Carn Doom. You remember those references?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So those people reestablished the kingdom here, but the Bree men were just their own thing still, and the new kingdom of Arnor, those rulers were like, all right, that's cool, you guys can be good subjects. But then eventually that kingdom broke apart, or I don't know, basically came to ruin, and Bree's still around after that. So it's kind of like, can survive anything, apparently.
Yeah, sort of a strange, hardy, and very independent place.
Mm-hmm.
No real allegiance to anything beyond themselves.
Yeah. All right, should we get into some geography stuff again here, though?
Yeah, sure.
All right, so as
where are we in the world?
Well, I'm thinking more so real world, actually. So, you know, like we had said, the Shire was basically like English countryside, and specifically Oxford. And then he goes into the Old Forest, and they go to the Withy Windle, and that's probably like a real place. Like, he just described something that was like a 15-minute walk from his office, right?
Right.
And then you get to the Downs, which are like 15 miles away in, I don't know, east of Oxford, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you keep going past...
Tolkien is basically just pulling references from his immediate surroundings when he was writing this.
Right. So if you go beyond those Downs, you finally get to the town of Brill, which this is what he's basing Bree off of.
Okay.
And so the name Brill, the philology on that one is it comes from a combination of both Bree and Hill. But Bree... And so this is going to spoil, like, what Bree means in the story here. But Bree just is just Welsh for hill. So basically, it's Brill is just hill, which is Okay. Kind of weird. So, like, apparently, so I'm getting this from Tom Shippey's books. So what he was saying was, it sounds like the name suggests the incoming English heard the word, used the description, but thought, you know, they heard the word brie because it was mm-hmm. Welsh and they didn't know what it meant. And they thought it was a description, but it turns out that was actually just a description for their hill. And so then they added hill to it as well as like the descriptive word, you know, mm-hmm. instead of like a proper name. So right. like they thought brie was a proper name, and then they put, okay, brie hill, because this is a hill, and then mm-hmm. but it turned out brie just meant hill too. So, yeah. And then within the context of this story, I think the dominant thing of feature about brie was that there was a big hill in it.
Right brie's on the front side of a hill, and these other smaller towns are around the back side or nearby.
Right, and so now the same kind of goes for a couple of the other towns, too. The Archet is based off the Welsh Archet, which just means the wood. And okay. that town is right near, I guess, what they were calling the Chet Wood. So okay. To really, you know, really drive it home. And then uh-huh. Combe or Coombe is from the Welsh word CWM. I don't know how it's a word without a vowel, but
CWM?
Yeah, Coombe. Coombe. but that means valley, and okay. the description of that one was that it was also in a deep valley to the east.
Okay.
So he's pulling these words from Welsh, and I don't know, it's kind of giving it like a little bit of a different feel than the Shire.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean,
also a little bit humorous that the town names are just like the literal translations of where they are.
Well, exactly, yeah. He's doing this on purpose, yeah. I mean, this is all intentional. But you know, unless you read, you know, what is it, Road to Middle Earth, you're not going to know that, you know?
Right.
But it still gives you the effect that it feels different. So it's like, again, like this two pages. Did this forward our plot at all? No. But did it add something to the story? I would say yes.
Certainly, yeah. Certainly. I would say it forwarded the plot in the sense that we now have a feeling of being in a stranger place.
I mean,
although we've encountered many strange places so far, but we're slowly moving our way into wilder and stranger places.
Yeah, all right.
And the types of names are now, they're different from the Shire names. Because even Buckland was sort of, those sound like Shire names. Like Withywindle and and Buckland are, they have sort of the cheerful ring that all the Shire names have.
Yeah. Let's keep going to the Prancing Pony, though.
Right. So, the hobbits arrive at night. They come to a locked gate, presumably to the town, I interpreted it.
Yeah. This is a gated community. Mm-hmm. Well, right. Yeah, so they
gated got a gated community wall in the medieval sense.
Right, so a wall for defense.
And so, at night, presumably, the gatekeeper is you know, very suspicious of anyone arriving at night. So, he wants to know who they are, what they're up to, what their plans are. Frodo and the rest are not all too friendly, don't really want to reveal too much information about themselves.
And Mary pulls off, too, that, you know, it used to be known that Bucklanders would be adventurous and just go for, like, a day journey out there, you know, for, like, the right. weekend. And so he tried to pull that we're just one of those, you know.
Yeah, and you guys used to be a lot more polite to us.
Yeah. Which, yeah, I don't know. Like, that insult, like, turning around on the insult is... It's a good strategy in the city. Like, it happens multiple times throughout right. these chapters.
Right. But the gatekeeper's kind of like, okay, geez, you know, go on your way.
Yeah.
Didn't mean any harm. And they continue on to the Prancing Pony, which...
Oh, don't forget, though. After they went through the gate, a dark figure hopped over the fence, too.
Yes. Very ominous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe, wasn't there even a word like slithered or something?
there's something like it. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Something very
faded into the shadows, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Creepy thing, and we don't know anything else about that.
Yeah.
So the Prancing Pony.
Yeah, three stories.
Yes, three stories tall. This sounds very familiar in my mind to like the other inns that we've seen so far, like the Green Dragon or something like that. Am I mixing things up? They passed through the Green Dragon in Buckland, right?
No, they didn't stay there. They wanted to go to, what was it, like the Golden Perch or something? They wanted to go to that on the way to Buckland, but then they, because Pippin wanted the beer, but then they cut across country instead to avoid the Black Riders and to take a straight line. But I mean, I don't know. It seems like kind of like it seems like what you'd expect from an inn, I guess.
Yeah, it's just sort of a quintessential old English inn or something like that. So they come, they stumble in, think bright, loud, smoky room filled with a bunch of townspeople and visitors all drinking together. The innkeeper is bustling around, bringing out pitchers of beer, and he seems friendly enough.
What's his name?
Barleyman Butterbur, which is kind of a ridiculous name, but pretty good. I guess in keeping with naming all the towns after the literal things like of where they are, he's Barleyman, like, serving up beer.
Yeah.
And he's presumably kind of a chubby guy, Butterbur.
Yeah. I feel like the movie nailed him, you know.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah.
So, he basically leads them to their rooms. The room at the inn is pretty full, but they have a few hobbit rooms left over. And they feed them dinner and then invites them to join the crowd in the common area because everyone will be very curious to inquire after the Shire folk, and they don't see people from there very often. So we get the same impression, at least I did, of, I think it was in one of the earlier chapters, when Sam's dad, gaffer.
Oh, I forgot about all those scenes. Yeah. I think that was the Green Dragon. Yeah, you're right.
Is that the gaffer?
Yeah.
He's hanging out with the Shire folk at an inn there, and, you know, everybody's sharing their gossip and wants to know what's going on, and they're a little bit suspicious of Bilbo and Frodo and what the relationship is. And this seems like a, you know, strange land, but effectively the same thing. You've got everyone gathered around, gossiping, telling stories, drinking, and so, of course, the newcomers are a welcome and strange sight.
Right. You're right that it seems pretty similar. It's just like the names are kind of changed. They said most of the names here are botanical as opposed to just something whimsical in the Shire.
Right.
but remember, Frodo's going by what again?
Mr. Underhill.
Yeah. And so there were actually Underhills already living here too, so they assumed Frodo had to be some long-lost cousin.
Right. I mean, you'd think maybe naming yourself Underhill is like the Hobbit version of saying, like, I'm
Smith, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Smith or Johnson or something.
Right.
And then you meet somebody with the same last name and they're like, oh my God, we're related. Tell me all about yourself and where you're from. And Frodo's kind of stumbling and trying to invent a backstory.
And what was his backstory?
What on earth he's doing here. Well, he kind of contrives on the spot that there are just some curious hobbits and he's working on a book.
Yeah,
he's interested in geography and history, and he's writing a book about hobbits who live east of the Shire and east of Bree, and he doesn't know where he's going with this. Everyone thinks it's pretty weird that he'd write a book, but, you know, of course he says he's interested in hobbits east of Bree, so immediately everybody starts jumping in with all their random stories, different things they've heard about people living in strange places, and he seems like he's okay for the moment.
Yeah, I feel like the cover of writing a book is pretty cliche at this point. Maybe it wasn't in 1940, but it is now.
And you also, mean as the kind of strange character in a place, you don't know what they're up to, and they just say, oh, I'm writing a book.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's just like, was this really like a real thing at some point that people just travel around writing books? Because I feel like that's just like such a like high class leisure activity.
Probably so. I mean, a lot of authors were pretty like high class individuals in history.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
I bet it was, because, you know, sometimes when you're traveling, you see like a sign somewhere that's like, oh yeah, so and so wrote this book while they were staying at this inn or something.
Yeah, that's true. Well, his is funny because it's supposed to be, seems like nonfiction, just doing history and geography.
Right.
All right. Anyways, though, then of course there's also the classic talk of like trouble down south, you know, because it sounds
a little
like
bit vague. I feel like you've got a lot of different things going on here. Go ahead.
Even the hobbits in the early chapters, even the hobbits have been hearing like news that like there's trouble a brewing, you know?
Right.
And then
we've heard the same sentence sort of paraphrased dozens of times, where it's like, there's weird talk about, or there were strange folks around the borders of the lands, or strange happenings.
But here we're actually, finally starting to get some results, because it's saying like a bunch of men are coming up the South Road, which is called the Greenway.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like more on the move, and they're looking for more peaceful lands to settle in. And it said the Bree folk were sympathetic, but plainly not ready to take on large numbers of strangers into their little land. Mm-hmm. And then there was the ominous note that one of the travelers said, if the Brelanders weren't ready, they might be forced anyways to make room for us.
And no one was happy about that. I guess you get the sense of, like, if this was one big game board or something, all the pieces are shifting, and we don't really know how much is going on or what's going on, but what was a pretty static geography around the Shire and everything is now, like, starting to twist and move a little bit. So something is afoot.
Just for, like, storytelling purposes, that's always what you want. You know?
Of course.
Like, you don't want something static, like, I guess when Bilbo was doing it, but, you know. Also, it goes without saying, this is what? The upteenth time of rest stops.
Of course.
On this book.
I mean, maybe it's the way of the hobbits, but they alternate between harrowing adventure journeys and then sitting around drinking and talking.
It does fit hobbits, but as we had talked about, I think in like the Bombadil chapter, Tolkien just didn't quite know what he was doing. So he kind of went pretty all in on just like, you know, the rest stops because...
Right.
That's what he knew to describe, and he didn't know what adventure was coming next anyway.
Right, exactly. And because of the, I guess you could say, the narrative structure of the story, we don't really... a bunch of information is exposed through dialogue. You know, like, we get certain history bits, like this description of Bree, just from our unknown narrator, or from, like, you know, third-person omniscient or whatever. And then sometimes we get some thoughts from Frodo or from Sam... But usually it's in the form of, like, a dream or, like, Frodo went to bed uncomfortable about X. But, you know, most of the information and, like, the workings of the characters' minds we get through dialogue. So
right.
Tolkien's kind of, maybe he is, like, trying to figure out what's going on in the story, but it's also pushing it forward. It's like, okay, push the adventure forward, then push dialogue. Adventure, dialogue, kind of switching back and forth. So, speaking of dialogue, there's a strange man sitting in the corner.
Right. All right. So, important to note, while this is going on, Frodo's been kind of quiet, you know, aloof in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's in his personality.
Well, and also the implication is that because he's not really willing to talk about himself too much, that he gets boring pretty quickly. And
right, that's true, too. Yeah.
Turn their attention to his louder, goofier friends.
Right. So, Pippin is, you know... hitting it off with everybody, and he's telling all
the showboat.
Like, yeah, and he's doing all like the top hits of Shire stories that he can uh-huh. recognize so that he can keep it going. But yeah, there's a mysterious guy in the corner. You want to read the description of him?
Suddenly, Frodo noticed that a strange looking weather beaten man sitting in the shadows near the wall was also listening intently to the hobbit talk. He had a tall tankard in front of him and was smoking a long stemmed pipe, curiously carved. His legs were stretched out before him, showing high boots of supple leather that fitted him well, but had seen much wear and were now caked with mud. A travel-stained cloak of heavy dark green cloth was drawn close about him, and in spite of the heat of the room, he wore a hood that overshadowed his face. But the gleam of his eyes could be seen as he watched the hobbits.
All right, so then Frodo asks Butterburn who he is. Butterburn tells him You know what? I think I say Butterburn. Butterburn tells him he's one of the rangers. They sound like shady people who wander all over, as we had kind of alluded to mm-hmm, at the beginning. Mm-hmm. He says this one's name is Strider. And it was funny. And he said it was funny that Frodo should ask him about him. But then all of a sudden, Butterburn had to go to another table and he left us hanging.
Right. We get the impression that Butterburn's head, he's always like, he's a little bit spacey or just overworked. And his mind is always somewhere else. And you don't really know whether or not you should be suspicious of this or...
Well, I just found it more annoying.
Like, yeah, you know, exactly. Like, there's something on the tip of his tongue and you just can't get to it.
And especially as the reader trying to accustom himself to this new place.
Right, know? Right. Another thing that this whole setup reminds me of is the way that like saloons in the West, in the American West are depicted. Like during Westward expansion is like where you've got these kind of rough types hanging out together. You've got cowboys or gold miners or whatever, like all sort of mixing and crossing paths. And Strider seems kind of like one of these cowboys who like shows up every now and then. It's always really beat up from the road, and so he's in the area, but he's not actually in the town all that much.
That also just reflects like how central these inns are. You know, like, this is, like, this is the not only the hangout spot and the entertainment spot, but this is, like, the hub of communication by far.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, that it draws all these different personalities there.
Right, right.
Anyways, though, Strider invites Frodo over.
Yes.
As Frodo drew near, he threw back his hood, showing a shaggy head of dark hair flecked with gray and a pale, stern face with a parakeet of gray eyes. Mm. Strider says he's pleased to meet him, but you should get your friends in line. Let's see. Oh, I got a bunch of notes. Oh, before we get dressed, that this is based off a real life event that happened to Tolkien.
No kidding. Yeah. Was he Frodo or cool. Was he Strider?
He was Frodo.
Okay. Let's hear it.
All right. Okay. So Tolkien, you know, he's best buds with C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. And then their whole group's the Inklings. I feel like that's kind of common knowledge. Hopefully we can do, like, a special on them at some point. But, I mean, we'll see.
Okay.
Don't hold your breath. Their main hangout spot was an inn, kind of like the... Or, well, not an inn, but a pub. Because mm-hmm. They didn't need inns, I guess, as much. Well, I don't know. Inns just... When did inns stop becoming the hangout spot and they just strictly went to pubs? You know, no rooms.
Well, I think if you're in a bigger city, it makes more sense that there's more pubs than inns, but...
Okay. Well, so anyways, their favorite pub was the Eagle and Child, and this is in Oxford. And so Tolkien was hanging out with, I guess, the Lewis brothers, and then Charles Williams was another one, and these are, like, the core guys of the Inklings. Mm-hmm. And so Tolkien notices, and I think these are his own words here, a strange, tall, gaunt man, half in khaki, half in mufti. I don't know what mufti is. Should I know it? All right. Okay. I shouldn't. If you don't know, I'm good. with a large, wide awake hat, bright eyes, and a hooked nose sitting in the corner. The others had their backs to him, but I could see in his eye that he was taking an interest in the conversation, quite unlike the ordinary pained astonishment of the British and American public at the presence of the Lewises and myself in the pub. So this guy's listening in on their conversation, sitting in the corner, just like Strider, you know, legs up probably and everything, you know,
right, like right.
With the, you know, barely can see the eyes out of the hood. So anyways, eventually busts into their conversation about Wordsworth, who's a poet.
Is this William Wordsworth?
I probably think. I don't know. I don't think that part's important. Anyways, it turns out this guy's name is Roy Campbell, and so he was a poet and a soldier who had come specifically to Oxford looking for Lewis and Tolkien to, like, talk with them, and he had been tipped off that he could find them here.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. But so then it, like, that leads to them, like, meeting up with him for, like, a week straight, and Lewis had actually wrote some article about him in some paper bashing him a little bit, and okay. So, like, they were debating that, but, like, it was, like, I think it was friendly. But where Lewis was aggressive with them, Tolkien was basically awestruck because he had, like, great respect for this guy because he had just come back from fighting in the Spanish Civil War. So this is, like, he probably wrote this, like, right around the time that he actually met this guy. Like, this happened, like, you know, in real time, I think.
Okay. So this is, like, maybe, late 30s or something like that?
Yeah, give or take, like, a year or so. But, yeah, this, like, I don't know. We're right around, like, 1939, 1940.
Okay. Intriguing.
Yeah. Well, anyways, that's the guy there.
Okay.
So, I don't know. Kind of funny that...
Yeah, it sounds amazingly similar to this encounter.
Right. But anyways, yeah, so it goes on, though, because Strider says...
Best look after your friends. Okay.
Yeah, nice to meet you, but yeah, get your boys in line. Because mm-hmm. at that point, Pippin was telling the Bilbo farewell story.
Right.
Which is like, what an idiot.
Right.
What an idiot. How can you be this dumb?
Right.
You know?
Is bound to start bringing up the name Baggins and starting to get people curious. And
right.
The implication is that Butterbur and some of the older folks at the inn are certainly knowledgeable and old enough to remember these events and, you know, start to put the pieces together. So Frodo, yeah, eager to avert this, jumps up on a table and, you know, starts to basically make a hooligan out of himself.
Yeah, all right, so it's important, you know, he jumps up on the table and he's like, oh, wow, this is immediately awkward and weird. You know, what was I thinking, right? Uh-huh. And so, like, so he's nervous, so, you know, when you're nervous, you're, like, you know, feeling around in your pockets and, like, you're all jittery and everything. So he feels the ring in there, and then what does it say? It seemed to him somehow as if the suggestion came to him from outside, from someone or something in the room to slip on the ring. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also noted that he firmly resists this idea and does not act on it.
Right.
He just holds the ring tightly instead. So then the Bree folk, they request a song since he's up there. He thanks them for the hospitality, and he hopes the Bree and Shire friendship can be renewed. It's like, oh, we're making great strides throughout this adventure, you know? but then the Bree folk request a song, so he comes up with a silly song that Bilbo made up, and only a few words are now remembered as a rule. That's kind of key for what we're going to talk about. Do you want to do the song here?
There is an inn, a merry old inn, beneath an old grey hill. And there they brew a beer so brown, and the man in the moon himself came down one night to drink his fill. The ostler has a tipsy cat that plays a five-stringed fiddle. And up and down he runs his bow, now squeaking high, now purring low, now sawing in the middle. The landlord keeps a little dog that's mighty fond of jokes. When there's good cheer among the guests, he cocks an ear at all the jests and laughs until he chokes. They also keep a horned cow as proud as any queen, but music turns her head like ale and makes her wave her tufted tail and dance upon the green. And oh, the rows of silver dishes and the store of silver spoons. For Sunday there's a special pair, and these they polish up with care on Saturday afternoons. The man in the moon was drinking deep, and the cat began to wail. A dish and a spoon and the table danced, the cow in the garden madly pranced, and the little dog chased his tail. The man in the moon took another mug, and then rolled beneath his chair, and there he dozed and dreamed of ale, till in the sky the stars were pale, and dawn was in the air. Then the ostler said to his tipsy cat, "The white horses of the moon, they neigh and champ their silver bits, for their master's been and drowned his wits, and the sun will be rising soon." So the cat in his fiddle played hey diddle diddle a jig that'll wake the dead. He squeaked and sawed and quickened the tune, while the landlord shook the man in the moon. "'It's after three," he said. They rolled the man slowly up the hill and bundled him into the moon, while his horses galloped up in rear, and the cow came capering like a deer, and the dish ran up with a spoon. Now quicker the fiddle, when deedle-dum-diddle, the dog began to roar. The cow and the horses stood on their heads, the guests all bounded from their beds and danced on the floor. With a ping and a pong, the fiddle strings broke, the cow jumped over the moon. The little dog laughed to see such fun, and the Saturday dish went off at a run with a silver Sunday spoon. The round moon rolled behind the hill as the sun raised up her head. She hardly believed her fiery eyes, for though it was day, to her surprise, they all went back to bed.
So what's he doing here with the song? Before, let's just interrupt the plot, because, you know, stuff happens, but it's like, does this song remind you of anything?
Well, it's kind of like a little children's nursery rhyme.
Yeah,
like,
hey diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle.
Yeah, exactly.
Cow jumped over the moon.
Right, and it sounds actually amazingly similar to that. Like, there's a cat, a dog, a fiddle, a cow.
The silver spoon and the plate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In addition, there's an innkeeper, I think. So it sounds like vaguely familiar with the setting and, yeah. Something yes. Playful and childish.
All right, so that was all intentional. That's actually what he's doing here. So what he's trying to do is he's trying his hand at artificially recreating the original song that devolved into the nursery rhyme that we now have left today.
Mm-hmm.
So this was from Tom Shippey's books. No one could call this a serious poem, but what it does is to provide a narrative and semi-rational frame for the string of totally irrational non sequiturs, which we call the nursery rhyme. Because if you listen to that, the nursery rhyme is like, what's going on? Like, this makes no sense.
Okay.
He's trying to give it the context. And this goes back to like what the Grimm brothers were doing with the Grimm's fairy tales,
right,
where like this was all that was left of what was probably like at least a more full story or a full-time myth.
Right, which Tolkien really admired. He had a lot of respect for the Grimm brothers, right?
Right.
You could say it's kind of like a maybe archaeology of mythology or of stories.
The Grimm brothers are like the pinnacle of philology. Mm-hmm. So I think they would have been like heroes to Tolkien.
Right. Unearthing old stories and meanings to things and basically piecing together an older version of a narrative.
Right. And so that's what he's trying to do here, though, is like he wants to just make the full version of the kid's nursery rhyme, you know?
Mm-hmm.
and if you even look at like it's the second to last verse. It goes, with a ping and a pong, the fiddle strings broke, the cow jumped over the moon, and the little dog laughed to see such fun, and the Saturday dish went off at a run with the silver Sunday spoon, which is like, that's basically the only verse that we have left, but even more detailed still.
Right, you know? Right.
You know, like how they try to go back and recreate like the dead languages, mm-hmm, out of the shared words in each language,
right,
come up with like the hypothetical ancestor one. This is what he's doing here. Like, it's like, we call that like asterisk words, where it's just like don't have a recorded use of this, but that's what it is. So this is like an asterisk poem almost.
Okay.
You know?
Pretty cool.
Right. And so it's like, okay, you can kind of imagine like some kids hear the song and then they just remember like they can only remember like a certain part. And so they just keep singing that part over and over again, which is like, you know, that's how you get down to the nursery rhyme. But I would even almost say, too, it's like, well, some of these like Vreelander men that were at this thing tonight, it's like they're going to go home to their families and they'll have had quite a bit to drink tonight. And so when they wake up all hungover the next day, it's like, oh, how did that song go? It was pretty good. But then, you know, I almost imagine like the only part that they can get out is like the nursery rhyme part that we have left.
Right. Which is more like gibberish relative to a story.
Right. Now, this is also kind of cool. Tolkien picked this, you know, nursery rhyme basically because he knew, I don't think he knew what it actually said, but he knew that there existed a Man in the Moon poem in Middle English from like Anglo-Saxon times.
Oh, interesting.
And so he's like, yeah, so he's like, this one is definitely like, this was probably definitely like a real thing. So I'm going to try to reconstruct that.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Very.
Again, you know, this is another one though. It's like, how long was this thing? This was a solid 2 pages of the book, this song.
Mm-hmm. That was a long one.
Did it forward the plot again?
No, certainly not.
No. But did it add something to the story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll debate you on the forwarding the plot because of what's about to happen.
Well, okay. But, well, actually, all right, fine. Well, let's get into it. So this song is met with wild applause.
I mean, so basically, Frodo's standing on a table doing karaoke. The bar loves it, and they ask him to do it again. Everyone's joining in because the tune is pretty simple, and some people know some of the words. Or rather, they know the tune, and they're pretty quick at picking up the words. And at the end of the song, when the cow jumps over the moon, Frodo leaps up in the air, trips and falls, and, like, you know, breaks a table or whatever, knocks a bunch of beer over, and everyone's laughing, except Frodo disappears when he hits the ground. Like he fell through the floor and everybody just is totally freaked out. They have no idea what's going on. All of a sudden, they're backing away from Pippin and Sam because they're like, who are these weirdos with the magician friend? Like, what weird outsiders have we brought into our inn? So the entire dynamic changes right away.
They're sobering up real fast.
Right.
Notably, too, the gatekeeper, some squint-eyed southerner, and some swarthy-looking man run outside right away.
Yes.
Like, it's like, whoa, that was a big deal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, what does Frodo do? He tries to go back and sits next to Strider, where he pulls off the ring there, and then he tries to play it off like, oh, I was just here the whole time, and nobody's believing this for a second.
I mean, in the kind of, I don't know what you would call it, this, like, old-time sort of drunken, let's figure out what happened. They sort of, the people bring in Barley Man Butterbur to say, like, you know, something ridiculous just happened. I saw what I saw. And Barley Man Butterbur is brought in as like a judge, like, hear the evidence and proclaim that these are weirdos.
Yeah.
And he's like, ah, you know, as long as he's paying his bill, I don't really care. He can go wherever he wants. And Frodo says, I'm just over here in the corner. Nothing happened. I just crawled away really quick.
Yeah.
So they're playing it off, but the whole group is basically weirded out, and they start saying goodbye to each other and leaving.
Now, but it's significant, though, when Frodo gets back into the corner there, there's the lines here. It said, how it came to be on his finger, he could not tell. He could only suppose that he had been handling it in his pocket while he sang, and that somehow it slipped on when he stuck out his hand with a jerk to save his fall. For the moment, he wondered if the ring itself had not played him a trick. Perhaps it had tried to reveal itself in response to some wish or command that was felt in the room. And so so he's sitting next to Strider too, and so Strider's basically like, you effed up big time. You really put your foot in it, or should I say your finger?
Mm-hmm.
And Frodo's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And Strider's just like, oh yes, you do. I want a word with you, Mr. Baggins.
Which Frodo ignores.
Right. Which, and then he also points out, he's just like, you might hear something that to your advantage, you know, might help you out a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that, though, that the one quote that I read there. This is the second time Frodo's used the ring. Where is the first?
The first time was...
I gave you it in the notes, buddy. It's in blue.
Oh, wait. He put it on in Bombadil's house?
Yeah.
When?
When Bombadil used it and it had no effect on him. And then Frodo was, like, actually disgusted by that. that he put it on just to make sure that it was still, like, the powerful thing.
Oh, I didn't realize that he put it on.
Yeah, and Bombadil could see him.
Okay.
Because Mary couldn't see him, but Bombadil could.
Ah, that's right, that's right. Okay.
Remember, and Bombadil's like, oh, I'm not that blind yet.
Right.
Clifford.
Okay, I'm sorry. I remember Bombadil putting it on, but I forgot about Frodo. So that's the second time that Frodo's put it on.
Yeah, well, so Bilbo used it a bunch, but yeah, this is only the second time Frodo did. Because as soon as Frodo got it, Gandalf was just like, keep it secret, keep it safe, don't use it.
You know? Mm-hmm.
So notable, though, of course, like we already noted before, that he had the desire to put on the ring, but he resists the temptation, and it says firmly, I know not to do this, basically, because it's like, Gandalf told me not to.
Right.
Plus, it doesn't seem like a good idea.
Right. Although we should note, like, he has nothing else to go off of besides Gandalf, who he trusts and respects, saying, don't do that. It's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he has some sort of intuition that he shouldn't do it too, though.
Right.
But the outside temptation, you know, is where, like, it was coming from, like, some sort of outside temptation is what we were saying before the song, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting. Yet despite his resistance, the ring still ends up on Frodo's finger, which effectively is going to alert Sauron's spies. Spoiler.
Right.
because the disappearance of Frodo, it's like, oh, that sounds a lot like the disappearance of Bilbo.
Right.
Which is a problem. Was it an accident that he put on the ring, or was it the ring that got onto Frodo's finger, you know?
Right.
Like, as in the ring is the actor here?
Right.
I don't know. Like, these are the open questions.
Well, I read it as we've kind of established that there's this temptation with the ring, and it does have, like, a sort of a will of its own that we talked about from The Hobbit.
Right, yeah. I was going to say, yeah, we established that when Bilbo first got it in that chapter.
So the ring is not passive in this situation. The ring is a little bit active. You can't call it a character, but it definitely has a role to play that's beyond what you would expect of an object. And then Frodo is trying to resist it, but he's in, I don't know, he's effectively in, like, a weakened situation. He's in a totally strange setting, and he's thrown into, like, a weird kind of doing karaoke on a table where he's totally uncomfortable. He doesn't know who's around him. He's trying to make a scene, but not too much of a scene. And so you can imagine that, like, whatever constitution he had that was kind of letting him stay calm and resist the temptation of this ring has been certainly weakened or sort of thrown off by how many weird things are going on. So mm-hmm. I see it as, like, coming from both sides. Like, the temptation might be extraordinarily strong, but also Frodo is in a less of a position to resist it well.
Well, that actually kind of brings up, too, what Fleming Rutledge in her Battle for Middle Earth book was bringing up. So she goes so far as to say, it was kind of funny, she mentioned some Richard Pryor comedy routine, you know, the comedian.
I think so, yeah.
He's too old. He's too way too old. Okay. For us. But anyway, she was mentioning, like, she's kind of describing the scene or something where he has, like, the scene about some alcoholic drinking, and, like, the alcoholics are just all like, oh, you know, I vowed not to drink, but it's like half of this bottle of rum just disappeared, you know? Like, how did that happen?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, and I said I wouldn't drink anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, is that kind of going on here with Frodo?
Right.
Like, you know, it's like, he resisted to put on the ring, but is there something, like, almost subconscious in him that is just like, he wanted to put on the ring?
Yeah, I'd say, you almost know? Certainly. That's...
Like, and that, like, but what's the desire to? He knows he shouldn't. He knows he shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, like, there's part of him, like, subconsciously, because he consciously accepted to not put it on, but there's part of him that was like, I kind of want to put this on, and that might just be, like, the total temptation of the ring for just power in general.
Right, right. You know? Exactly. He knows that he's not supposed to put it on, but he knows it's powerful, so almost the curiosity alone is enough to sort of suck him in. And then he's in a position where he's, like, kind of wishes he could be in a little bit more control. And so yeah. I'd say it's not all that surprising. But point being, Frodo is now sitting in the corner, and Strider rightly points out that he's drawn more attention to him. He's made much more of a scene than Pippin could have hoped to, just telling the story about Bilbo. So it's the worst possible scenario.
Right, and so the chapter kind of finishes with Strider says he wants to talk to Frodo tonight, and then Butterbur also remembers he has something to tell Frodo, and he wants to meet him tonight, too.
In private.
So Frodo ends the chapter, right. So Frodo ends the chapter, walk into his room, thinking like, oh, man, all these meetings, all these people, they all want part of me.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what's going to happen next. This has been a busy
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the chapter ends.
Thank you.
Last thing to talk about for tonight, though.
Okay.
The drafts of this. So we haven't been talking about the drafts very much, partly because I'm forgetting half the time, partly because for those Bombadil chapters, he was basically getting like the broad essentials like within one draft, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But it's just like, but it also kind of makes sense because he's like, he's thrown in the adventure, you know, it's like he doesn't have anywhere he's going with the story. And so it's like those chapters that didn't really advance like the plot, like the overall plot. Mm-hmm. It's like, kind of makes sense that he just gets those and, you know, they're good.
Right.
Good to go.
Right.
Right. This chapter, he has all sorts of different drafts going on, and it was super hard for Christopher Tolkien to even try to present it. So he only gives like one main rough draft, I guess, is what you could say. And it's like kind of like the culmination of like a bunch of stuff where he's just like literally erasing crap as he goes and putting like in like slips of paper and stuff because, you know, obviously he didn't have a computer. It's not like he was typing all this crap. So it probably just looked really ugly. You know, like he writes stuff in pencil and then he erases it and writes over in pen and it's barely legible and everything. Like it's chicken scratch, you know. Just want to go over a couple of things about that chapter because there is one extremely, extremely noticeable difference. that's pretty key because it goes on for a while throughout the drafts. So a couple minor changes. The city is just all hobbits. Bree is just all hobbits, which is kind of weird. But, you know, even in the drafts, he's kind of flip-flopping between that and men and hobbits or just men or just hobbits, whatever. It was Barnabas Butterburn. Of course, Frodo is still named Bingo at this point, but he was going by Mr. Hill instead of Underhill. So it's like Hill even more bland. And then basically everything's still the same throughout the draft until you get to Strider, or as he was called here, Trotter.
Gotta say, this whole early round of names is just a little bit ridiculous.
Well, all right, well, I haven't touched on this. In this early round of names, there's four hobbits there, but Sam really hasn't been invented. It's more so actually just Fatty traveling with them. And then, like, their names were, this is so confusing, their names were Bingo, Odo, Frodo, and Marmaduke, who went by Mary. So Mary was him. Frodo, I think, was actually Pippin. And then Odo was actually more so Fatty Bulger, and like Sam really kind of just did not exist yet.
Okay, interesting.
And then yeah, Bingo. It's like Bingo Bulger Baggins. It's like, oh, so terrible, so terrible. Yes, thank God we got the change. You know,
no kidding. he does, as we saw in The Hobbit, he does have a real penchant for like nickname or naming related groups, like rhyming or similar sounding names, like the dwarves.
Right, right.
All the
that's
family
true.
Members all sound the same, and then. I mean, even still, like, Bilbo, Frodo are somewhat similar, and then we'll see, I think, later in the book, other related characters have similar names.
Yeah. Anyways, though, he gets to Trotter, and so it's like, you know, Trotter staring him from the corner or whatever, and so then, this is that scene, you know. So let me read this quote that was in the drafts here. Suddenly, Bingo noticed that a queer-looking, brown-faced hobbit sitting in the shadows behind the others was also listening intently. He had an enormous mug, more like a jug, in front of him, and was smoking a broken-stemmed pipe right under his rather long nose. He was dressed in dark, rough brown cloth and had a hood on. In spite of the warmth and, very remarkably, he had wooden shoes. Bingo could see them sticking out under the table in front of him. Butterburn then says, that's Trotter. You can hear his clitter clapping shoes as he comes walking down the paths. Other than that, the rest of the chapter is basically the same, but it's just like, that is a huge, huge, huge change.
Weird.
Any thoughts?
I mean, it's hard to take seriously with the name Trotter. Trotter wearing wooden shoes.
But Strider's not that far off. It's just so much more fit.
No, but I mean, Trotter is like, that's a pig part.
No, Trotter's like, you're trotting along, and then Strider, you're striding along in the woods.
Yeah, I know, but people eat
Trotters. I don't know.
Pig feet.
I'm not very familiar with that, but... The wooden shoes is ridiculous.
It is.
Because he's a hobbit, and then he's also wearing shoes. And not only is he wearing shoes, they're wooden.
Right.
Now, there's actually, I think there's reasoning behind that. Maybe we'll get into that eventually, unless I forget again. Just going to be honest. But, yeah, I think we'll try to check in with Trotter at least once more throughout the drafts.
Cause, okay.
Because he goes, like, decent, like, embarrassingly long into this story.
Before changing the name.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, the Strider, the concept of Strider, it took a little bit.
Okay.
A little bit, you know? And that's why we review the drafts.
One thing that stands out at this point in this in the story with Strider as opposed to Trotter is that particularly I think that he's a man instead of a hobbit, is that he really comes off as like the adult in the room, maybe. He's sort of mysterious and quiet. We don't really know what's going on yet, but he's definitely much calmer, more knowledgeable, and seems like a little bit old and wise in a way that nobody else in the inn is.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. Trotter actually still, for being a goofy hobbit, he's still, I don't know, he somewhat got that across in the draft.
Okay, okay.
But yeah, I think we'll talk about more of Strider next chapter, I think.
Yes.
You know, because it might be named after him.
Well, stay tuned for Chapter 10, coming to you soon, where we'll dive into what happens next in this fraught situation in the middle of the Prancing Pony in Bree.
Okay.
Okay, Clifford, back again on this New Year's Day.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, sorry.
How are you?
Good. Well, first, let me just address the audience. Sorry we didn't put out an episode last week. We were planning on it, but then I looked that was Christmas Day itself. And also, I was coming home, and I wasn't going to be, like, kind of prepared to do everything. So, anyways, we just delayed it a week, you know. Give respect to...
I don't know if anyone's going to forgive you, Patrick.
Give respect to the great holiday. Yeah, I don't think anybody... Very few percentage of our audience will have listened to this in, like, real time. But, anyways. Yeah, yes. New Year's. How you been? How was Mexico?
Mexico was wonderful.
Nice.
Yeah. Tulum is pretty swanky. Beaches were really nice. Yeah, it was good. Good to see your family.
Nice.
How's Chicago been?
Dude, it was, well, up until 2 days ago, this is like the warmest Christmas I've ever had here.
Weird.
Yeah, shocking, like 60 degrees almost, and like sunny. And
very strange.
Usually, like, you know, because I live in Colorado now, but it's just like, there it's just like, ugh. Snow on Halloween and Easter, and then it's like, you know, a sunny Christmas is nothing special there, whereas here it is.
Uh-huh.
So instead of just like thinking like, ugh, the weather's being stupid, I just kind of enjoyed it this time because it's like, well, this is rare for Chicago. Whereas in Colorado, it's like, no,
yeah,
it's just dumb. Like, that's how it always is, but it's like, that's not right. Whereas here, it's like, oh, this is just, I guess, a special treat. Like, we were playing like bags, or as some people say, cornhole.
Out
at the party, you know?
Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You prefer the fluke weather to the consistent irregularity of Colorado.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. Like, I mean, I dream of a white Christmas, Clifford. I dream of it just like anybody, you know.
It's always green.
Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
I'm trying to eat less meat. Trying to be bit more vegan.
I have the same. That's one of them.
Nice.
I'm doing a century ride every month.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know. I'm going to have to keep me in shape. That. Yeah.
Dude. For the non-cyclists among us, what does that mean?
100 miles, like in basically like one shot. Like, I could stop for lunch, but like I can't like change clothes. It's the same bike ride, you know?
Yeah. So at some point in month, you're going to do one of those.
Yeah.
That's cool. Kind of abstractly starting marathon training. I'm going to do the San Francisco Marathon in the summer.
What about biking training, you know?
Been biking to work. I was kind of thinking that if I just keep a regular routine commuting, that's a pretty good New Year's resolution for me.
Yeah.
It's just like going to work every day and being consistent about it, because I've got like a 45-minute bike ride each way. 45 minutes to an hour, depending on where I go.
Right.
Which is good. Haul.
Okay, I thought we had a review for today, but I think I screwed up and we don't. Yeah, well, I think we can just leave it off here because the episode, no, very long. The one we just recorded was another long one. Two back-to-back long ones coming up for future reference. But yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. I think we're looking forward to a good 2020. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, y'all.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Fish man.
do it one more time.